The first half of July was marked by heavy rains, storms, and flooding. The second half looks a little better weather-wise, but as far as the news cycle goes, it's been pouring headlines. Coming up on this episode of The Eagle, we'll go over the week's top news.
A new chip fab will be constructed that will add 1,000 jobs and double the manufacturing capacity of the Global Foundries facility.
We'll remember iconic former Times Union editor-in-chief Harry Rosenfeld.
This was a solemn time in the history of the nation, and our behavior had to reflect that we recognize that.
And is there really buried treasure somewhere in the Hudson Valley?
There are so many versions of the legend and story, and it's one of the reasons why people become so fascinated by it.
This is The Eagle, a Times Union podcast, a look inside our newsroom. I'm Jessica Marshall.
If you're enjoying this podcast, take advantage of all the Times Union has to offer and support our efforts to bring in you award-winning journalism by becoming a Times Union member today. Go to timesunion.com/subscribe.
Welcome to The Eagle. I'm Jessica Marshall. First up, let's go over what appeared this week in the Times Union and on timesunion.com. All right, we are here with Times Union editor-in-chief Casey Seiler. We're going to go over the top headlines as always. Let's start with, we've been following a class action lawsuit that involves toxic water pollution in Hoosick Falls. This has been for many years now, but this week a $65 million settlement was reached with the companies that are to blame. Can you tell us more about that?
So this goes back to a story that Brendan Lyons first reported back in December of 2015, when he wrote about testing that had been done by a private citizen of private and municipal water in Hoosick Falls that turned up elevated levels of the substance known as PFOA. Please don't make me pronounce the long version of the name, which is a chemical that is used, or a compound, I should say, that is used in the production of Teflon, among other things. It has also been connected to various ailments in humans, including various forms of cancer. What has ensued over the course of the last 6 years is kind of a corporate, state, and legal saga that came to, well, if not the end, at least perhaps a potential beginning of the final act, with the announcement of an agreement with three of the companies that were identified as being responsible in whole or part for the PFOA contamination of the village of Hoosick Falls water. And the sum involved, the proposed sum, is $65.25 million, which is a large amount. And yet at the same time, you're already seeing people say that's, you know, if you parcel that out among all the households involved that have allegedly been harmed here, whether from loss of property value or, much worse, fear over the medical implications of PFOA contamination in your bloodstream, it adds up to not a whole lot of money. But it is receiving praise from many within the village, including local leaders and even some of the people who were involved in blowing the whistle initially, especially because in addition to sums for, you know, harm to property values, it would provide for 10 years of medical monitoring to make sure, as hopefully PFOA levels drop in one's bloodstream, there aren't kind of knock-on effects of the contamination. It would also allow people who do or have turned up with PFOA in their systems, if later on they do develop some of the health effects that have been linked to PFOA, they would still be able to bring action against these companies. So it still needs to be approved by a judge. It still needs to be approved by, you know, the affected classes here. But it's definitely a major turning point in the effort to bring some justice to the people of Hoosick Falls and the surrounding area. It's also worth noting that one of the companies allegedly involved in the contamination, DuPont, is not involved in this settlement. So there is likely to be continuing legal action involving that defendant.
Well, that is a huge story for us. And I believe it's pronounced perfluorooctanoic acid.
I'm not going to question you on that.
Well, another huge story that broke this week, big news from Malta, specifically from Global Foundries. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and the Federal Secretary of Commerce were up in Malta on Monday for the announcement that a new chip fab will be constructed that will add 1,000 jobs and double the manufacturing capacity of the Global Foundries facility up there. Big news, definitely a feather in the cap of what we like to think of as Tech Valley. The second fab will be known as Fab 8.2. And Larry Rulison, who was up there covering this announcement for us, noted that while the company hasn't announced what it's going to cost, these types of fabs are usually $10 to $15 billion investments to build them and equip them. So it's pretty remarkable.
That is indeed exciting news. Now, news that's not so exciting. We're hearing about COVID cases ramping back up again around the country and really something we didn't want to ever hear again here in the region. So can you tell us what's the latest there? What happened this week?
It's a reminder that as we hear more about what is becoming something of an epidemic among the unvaccinated, that there are still a significant number of New Yorkers who have not been either partially or fully vaccinated still. And of course, there are breakout cases even among the vaccinated. This week, there was news of a breakout down in Columbia County at a sleepaway camp called Camp Pontiac, where 23 campers have tested positive. They are either quarantining at the camp or they have been safely sent home. But of course, there are scores of other campers who have had significant contact with those who have been identified as COVID positive. And what's interesting is that Columbia County, at the time the story was published, was reporting 14 active COVID cases, but Camp Pontiac on its own is reporting 23. But those are counted back in their home county. So if you're a camper who comes from Manhattan, you're being counted in their positive case, not in Columbia County, despite the fact that you might be in your bunkhouse or perhaps a quarantine bunkhouse at the camp.
All right. More on that and everything that we talk about here in this segment on timesunion.com. Finally, before I let you go, we lost a legend this week, one of our own here at the Times Union. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, Harry Rosenfeld, who was the Times Union's editor-in-chief from 1978 all the way to 1994 and remained on the job as editor-at-large and a member of the editorial board until his death a week ago Friday, was an outsized character. He came to the Times Union from the Washington Post, where he was the managing editor for Metro News, which means that he was the editor for city reporters, Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward, during Watergate, and edited a lot of their coverage exposing the crimes of the Nixon administration. And came to Albany and remained a dogged enemy of corruption and a scourge of officials who would not answer a straight question with a straight answer. He was a very important figure to me, somebody who was extremely supportive as I moved into the position as editor-in-chief as well. Just a fascinating individual. And I can't imagine anybody here in the newsroom who knew Harry well wasn't affected and improved by having been close to him. Jess, at your suggestion, I sat down with Jay Jochnowitz and Akeem Norder, who are two members of the editorial board who served alongside Harry and got their memories of him.
One of the few things I knew about Albany before coming here was the amplitude and tenure of its democratic regime. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what it was known for, as a machine political operation. So it was a natural target, and it would have been, disgraceful for me to avoid looking at it squarely in the eye.
I am a relatively new arrival to the editorial board. You served alongside Harry Rosenfeld for considerably longer. So I guess the question I would put to you is, what did Harry bring to the board, and what was it like to discuss the issues of the day with him twice a week in our editorial board meetings?
Well, I think first and foremost, he brought to the board an absolutely unfiltered newsman. And by that, you know, he and I have very different styles. I could only imagine what Harry would have been like as a reporter. He was an editor, I think, virtually all of his career, except for, you know, a few stints here and there. But you did not know what Harry might do in an editorial board meeting when it came to either challenging you personally, you know, as one of the members of the editorial board on your position, and, you know, and bluntly, he didn't sugarcoat it. If you were in a meeting with a public official who was, prevaricating or just being obtuse or difficult or evasive or anything, you know, Harry just let him have it. And it was refreshing for those of us who maybe, you know, are sometimes, you know, more polite than we even want to be and perhaps should be in the face of people who don't deserve it. He was just excellent at that. And yet there was nothing. Even if it was combative, it was not. It was never meant to be hurtful. It just was calling you out quite honestly. So that was that's what he brought, I think, to the table. That was distinct about Harry.
Akeem, what would you add to that?
Yeah, I would say that Harry believed that the role of the press was to expose abuses of power in the government or in the private sector. I mean, injustice and corruption and hypocrisy, he saw all of them as threats to democracy, because these kind of abuses move us farther away from our country's ideals. He drew a direct line between the atrocities that he witnessed in his childhood and the steps toward authoritarianism that he saw in our country over the past several years. At one point, a couple of years ago, I remember him saying almost to himself, "I can't believe this is happening again." He saw very clearly that these were actions that could lead to a dangerous place. And he saw it as our role to bring that message to the public, to, you know, connect the dots and describe for people that larger context, that daily outrages of public officials together were making up a systematic and potentially very sinister change in our country. And he kept us focused on that. You know, we'd be discussing some kerfluffle up in Saratoga County or a glitch in policy in, I don't know, the water department. And he would say, "Pardon me for interrupting this worthy discussion, but could we focus instead on the fact that our democracy is in danger?"
Yeah, he hated Donald Trump. And I think that's fair to say. And he didn't hate Donald Trump because he was a Republican, and he didn't hate him because he claimed to be a conservative. He hated him because, for Harry, and Harry laid out the case, as Akeem noted, very precisely, very methodically, very forensically, that what this country was flirting with in embracing Trump to the extent that it did was something that, for Harry, echoed, as Akeem put it, what drove Harry and his family out of Berlin, out of Germany, when he was a child.
I think it's worth really emphasizing that point, that this was not a Republican or Democrat issue. This was about this particular individual and the problems he brought to the American political scene. Harry was not a liberal. He was not a conservative. He was a very pragmatic. I don't know what his politics were, but I do know that he was. When we argued with him, he'd call you out on ideology if he felt that it was not well grounded in, if the argument itself was not well grounded in in facts, and it wasn't thought out over a long term. So we had many arguments on the issue of immigration, for example, that I think I hold a more liberal view. Harry did not hold a conservative view by any means, but he did not hold a very liberal view either. He felt it really needed to be looked at as a problem in and of itself. We needed to see it for the problems, see illegal immigration for the problems that it caused. But we also could not, be abusing people and doing the things we were to families. I think, we were always looking for that balance, and he was always prodding us to find that balance in that position, and many others.
I wrote in my column after Harry passed away about one of my favorite editorial board interactions that I saw him take part in. This was actually before I was a member of the editorial board, but I sat in on a visit from Troy Mayor Patrick Madden, who was incensed that Chris Churchill, our columnist and another member of the editorial board, had charged him with taking part in a cover-up for refusing to release a document that explained or gave justification to the Troy police for not disciplining an officer who had shot a black motorist, Edson Thevenin, after Thevenin fled a DUI stop. This, of course, was a story that has echoed since, Thevenin died a half dozen years ago and continues as a federal lawsuit. And Madden kept saying, well, we're keeping this document secret because it's attorney-client work product. The mayor and I went back and forth, and then there was a pause, and Harry stepped in. And that was an exchange that I, to this day, keep on my phone. And as I wrote in my column, I take it out and listen to it every now and again when I need to have my spine stiffened.
Mayor, do you have any idea of what your appearance this morning before this board tells this board?
No.
That you're a bureaucrat and you will use any means of bureaucracy to keep the truth from coming out.
I'm not keeping the... I'm ready for this to go to trial.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not.
If they call tomorrow and said trial date's Monday, we're
good. You have been mayor throughout this whole story incident. And it's time for the people to know what the hell happened here and whether there's a protection game going on within your police department. That's what you need to address. Not the niceties of your dancing around these points in front of an editorial board. If you don't have anything more to say than what you've come to say, why do you bother? What do you hope to achieve? You think we say, oh yeah, he's right, we'll wait. We won't wait. We're going to use every power that we have to find out what's going on, to tell the public what went on.
Yeah, that was a meeting to remember. There was another, the other one that I remember, I'm not going to mention who the person was, but it's a former Times Union journalist who was now doing public affairs, and he had come in to try to change our position on one of his clients. Harry, the argument that he was making was thin by any standard, and he didn't quite lie to us, but it was very disingenuous. And I will just never forget how Harry just at one point, I think he cut him off. He couldn't take it anymore. And he said, I cannot believe that you were a reporter in this newsroom and now you are trying to pass this and I'll have to bleep it myself. Because I think Harry used a rare expletive in that meeting and told him that this was just shameful that he would come into the room and try to pass this off on us. Personally shameful to him as well as just shameful in general. It was scathing. And yet, couldn't argue with him on it. He was right.
Akeem, do you have any story similar to that?
Oof. I was not at either of those meetings or wish that I had been to. I definitely know what it was. It was a treat to argue with Harry. But if you tried to do it and you didn't have your facts to back it up, he was going to cut you into pieces pretty quickly. One of the biggest compliments I've ever received in my career is that he said to me once, he said, I don't want to argue with you because you're good. I'm like, after the meeting, I'm like calling my husband. Like, Harry said I was good. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, Harry once, after one editorial board meeting where there was some sparring, Harry spoke of my questioning, and I can't remember who it was. It might have been the governor, where he said, it shows what somebody does under questioning from a real newspaper man. And if you will forgive me the gendered expression, that compliment sent chills up and down my spine when I got it from somebody with Harry's gravitas. Well, thank you both very much for taking the time to talk about somebody who we all miss very much, but whose influence I think we will continue to feel for many years.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
As always, you can read more about all the stories and the issues that we discuss on this podcast at timesunion.com. After the break, did a 1930s gangster hide treasure worth millions somewhere in the Hudson Valley? We'll discuss this pervasive legend.
Hi, I'm Casey Seiler, editor of the Times Union. Join us for an ongoing discussion on major developments in the saga of Keith Raniere, co-founder of Nexium, the shadowy upstate New York organization at the center of the explosive federal investigation that resulted in Raniere's conviction on charges of extortion, sex trafficking, and more. We talk to former members of Nexium, discuss the latest news, and preview the likely next twists in this bizarre and disturbing story. You can find Nexium on Trial at timesunion.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Eagle, a Times Union podcast. I'm Jessica Marshall. New York's Hudson Valley is a destination for many things. Outdoor adventure in summer, leaf peeping in fall, a rich arts, culture, and culinary scene year-round, to name just a few. But what if I told you there was treasure worth millions of dollars hidden somewhere in the region? Would that entice you to visit? Legend has it that New York-based gangster Dutch Schultz secreted a massive bounty in the Catskills before he was murdered in 1935. It's only a rumor, there's never been any proof, but he was said to have hinted at it on his deathbed, and that has drawn scores of treasure seekers to the region in the last seven decades. Hudson Valley News editor Chloe Callahan recently took a dive into that legend, and we chatted about what she discovered. Who is Dutch Schultz?
He was born in the Bronx in 1901 to German Jewish immigrant parents, and he was actually given the name Arthur Flegenheimer at birth. So Dutch Schultz didn't come along till he was in his teens, when he was a part of the Bronx's Frog Hollow Gang, who actually bestowed the name to its toughest members. So he wasn't the first Dutch Schultz, but he was the last. It stuck with him. Over time, he became and really built his reputation as a top bootlegger. He really was the guy on the western side of the Hudson River, from everywhere between New York City to Canada. He was a racketeer and the first mobster to extort New York's labor unions. So he really created this reputation for himself.
What was his personality like?
Yeah, so his personality really was, having a white hot temper. He kind of had loose lips. He was one to kind of just do things off the switch. He was known for having one ruthless incident in Cohoes, which was outlined in the book Five Families by Selwyn Rabb. And in that, they explained how he shot another gangster in the mouth at a hotel, just as casually as if he was picking his teeth. So he was very kind of did what he want. But at the same time, in our conversations with historian John Conway, he explained that sometimes his hot-headed reputation was a front in ways, and that he actually wasn't as tough as he always came off to be.
Interesting. Wow, I feel like there's a movie in here somewhere, you know, like a really dramatic old school gangster film. Now, he did not meet a very good end. How did he go out?
he kind of kept building his reputation up. So he became public enemy number one. And that was when J. Edgar Hoover, the first director of the FBI, labeled him as that in 1933 after the fall of Al Capone, who was in Chicago. So Dutch Schultz, as we know, is in New York. And then he kind of drew the attention of prosecutor Thomas E. Dewey, who later was governor of New York, and went after Schultz for tax evasion. So while he was never convicted for that, he didn't like that this prosecutor kept going after him. So he said, all right, what I have to do is kill Thomas E. Dewey. But at the time, there was already a commission, syndicate, board of directors type thing between New York's criminal underworld that was made up of a bunch of different mobsters and gangsters. And they didn't want Schultz to kill Dewey. Schultz still wanted to. So at the end of the day, in a twist of fate, they said, the syndicate commission said, we have to kill Schultz. And that's exactly what they did. He was gunned down in Newark's Palace Chop House on October 23rd, 1935. And he didn't die there right away. He had about 24 hours in the hospital before he eventually succumbed to the fatal injuries.
I'm telling you, the script is already written itself here. This is so compelling. All right, so that kind of is where his story picks up some more modern relevance, because something interesting happened on his deathbed. Can you talk about that?
Exactly. So he laid on his deathbed for about 24 hours, like I mentioned, and he was babbling out all sorts of things as the police sat there and took notes. He had a bunch of strange phrases. One of them was, a boy has never wept nor dashed a thousand kin. But what largely sparked the relevance to today is when he said one babbling that read, don't let Satan draw you too fast. At the same time, police were said to take notes that he mentioned that he had a treasure somewhere hidden in Phoenicia. This wasn't verbatim per se, because the police didn't really want that part to get out as much. But crime historians today think that they did hear exactly that there was a treasure in Phoenicia.
Was there an indication as to what that treasure might be?
Yeah, so the legend says that the treasure is said to be a mix of gold coins, jewelry, paper bonds, and money somewhere in a steel box, waterproof safe, or suitcase. In 1935 money, that loot was estimated to be worth between $5 million and $9 million, but today that would be $50 to $100 million, depending
on.
It's a large sum of money.
So this was money that he had hoarded and allegedly hidden. So what is the connection between his statement about the devil and this treasure? And why is that something that we're still kind of obsessed with today?
Exactly. So when he made this statement, don't let Satan draw you too fast, people knew already that he had familiarity with the Catskills. And they knew that there was a large boulder called Devil's Tombstone and a rock outcropping called Devil's Face. There's also the Devil's Path that's nearby.
This is in Phoenicia?
Yes, this is in Phoenicia in the Catskills. So people felt if the treasure is somewhere hidden, you know, maybe it is in Phoenicia where all these weird devil terms are, and they made this connection. And that's where people really started looking for the treasure. But in our conversations with John Conway, the Sullivan County historian, he said, we have to remember that these were city men. So people who were out looking for it, even though people dug way beneath the earth, he said, they probably didn't go out there with their hiking gear and their boots on. So he thinks maybe it's hidden instead of, you know, below the earth somewhere. So there's a bunch of different, I guess, ideas that people have of where the treasure might be, but it really heavily has been looked for in Phoenicia in the Catskills.
That's fascinating. And people still look for it today, right?
Exactly. So, you know, calling the Phoenicia Library, they said still today people come in and ask, do you have maps for the of where people look for this? Where can we get more info about it? And also, there's been crazy stories of people over time looking for the treasure that John Conway shared with us. For example, one person dug near the tracks of the Ulster and Delaware Railroad so much that it unleveled the tracks and officials had to ask him to stop. And then another example was that someone who owned a campground in the area where the treasure potentially was had people sign an agreement saying that she would get a portion of the treasure if it was found on her property. But when her yard was completely dug up, she put an end to that. So even today, though, you could take a spin on Google. You could see people have treasure maps of where they think it might be. And people still, even as recently as this past May, someone stayed in a Airbnb in Phoenicia and wrote in the review, hey, this is near where the treasure might be hidden. And we went for a walk just for fun to see if they could find it.
Wow. Well, that's going to jack up that Airbnb's popularity for sure. Now, Phoenicia is not the only place that people believe it could possibly be, right? There's a couple other places, like maybe in the Adirondacks.
Exactly. Conway also told us that there have been other rumored spaces like Lake George and even in Yonkers too. But the thing that's really interesting about the whole legend and story is that no one really knows for sure. Conway said how there's so many versions of the legend and story, and it's one of the reasons why people become so fascinated by it, because they're challenged to find the right version and then also challenged to find the treasure.
Now, did you know about this legend? You're from the Hudson Valley. Did you know about this going into reporting on it?
Yeah, I am from the Hudson Valley, but I didn't know too much about it before going into it. I heard of Duchess Spirits, which is more new distillery up in the area as well, who named it after Dutch Schultz. But other than that, I didn't know too much. So it was very exciting to uncover and hear a little bit more about this.
Well, good luck to all you treasure hunters out there. One last thing before we head out this week. We want to wish the best of luck to our local athletes competing at the Olympics in Tokyo. And meanwhile, another local athlete was honored this week. Troy powerlifter Tom Mooney was selected to compete with a delegate of New York athletes headed to next year's Special Olympics USA Games.
But I have an athlete who works every single day. Yeah, his mother doesn't even know. Come on up here, Annie and Tommy Mooney. Oh, works every day. Never stop. He did 10 a day. He is going USA.
Reporter Claire Bryan caught up with him after he learned he was selected.
What do you hope happens when you compete this time in powerlifting?
What's the goal?
My goal is to
which one lived in the shop?
Be healthy.
Wow.
And
nice.
What kind of medal do you want to get?
I want to get first place. I will do my best.
All right, that's it for this week. I'm Jessica Marshall. Next week, we're taking a short break, but we'll be back the week after with another look inside the newsroom here at the Times Union. In the meantime, check us out on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram, or head over to timesunion.com for the latest news and features. The Eagle is a production of the Times Union. It's produced and edited by me, Jessica Marshall, with help from the Times Union digital team and the newsroom. Special thanks this week to Casey Seiler, Akeem Norder, Jay Jochnowitz, Chloe Callahan, and Claire Bryan for their reporting and contribution to this episode.